You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Hi, I'm Madigan, and you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, a podcast that explores the world through a personal feminist perspective. Hi, everyone. I'm finally here with the brand new episode. Let me start my apology segment of this episode. Last week, I was house/dog sitting, so I was away from the studio quite a lot because this dog apparently can't be left alone for more than like 2 hours. So it didn't leave me a lot of time to be home for recording and editing and such. And I was a little all over the place last week. And then on Sunday, when I normally record, I had a Dodger game to go to. That ended up being a very long, hectic day as well. And I was like, you know what? It's fine. I'll record on Monday and put it up by the end of the day. Well, I ended up having nanny jobs the entire day because I had gotten my schedule confused. And then yesterday, which was Tuesday, I woke up feeling like actual hell. I'm pretty sure it's just allergies mixed with like probably some burnout, but I was dead to the world until like 4 p.m. yesterday. And I was supposed to do some nannying yesterday as well, but that didn't happen because I was like, I don't know if I'm actually sick. So just in case, like maybe I'll stay home. And I kind of treated it like a sick day. I feel much better today. I'm still a little bit phlegmy, but you know, too much information, that's not what you're here for. But I did want to explain why this episode is going up so late, and I really apologize. I do have a bit of a pet peeve when people still record episodes when they sound incredibly sick. I feel like I could get away with it when Keegan was on the show because half the time you had a normal sounding person. But when it's just me, I just think it would be insufferable for everyone listening, and I didn't want to put you through that. So now that I am feeling better and sounding better, I want to get into this episode. But before I get into it, I want to give a very important trigger warning. This is going to be a pretty heavy episode. This episode contains reference to sexual assault, violence, pregnancy and childbirth, miscarriages and abortion, and the murder of children. As always, I've decided to forego any graphic details, but if the mention of any of those topics is triggering for you, you may want to sit this episode out. If I have any Irish listeners, I'm sure you are already very well aware of this story, but this isn't something that I was aware of until maybe about a year ago or so. And it's a case that I found very fascinating in the true crime sphere. But the thing that really drew me to it was the social context of everything that was going on in the background of this story. Okay, I feel like the first sentence is the roughest, but here we go. On April 14, 1984, in County Kerry, Ireland, a newborn baby boy was found murdered. The body of the baby was discovered on the rocks at White Strand Beach by farmer Jack Griffin, who was on a run on his way to the farm. He had paused to check in on some cattle when he saw what he thought was a doll in the sand. The child would be named Baby John by investigators, and around the body they found no trace of the baby's parents or any indication as to where the baby had come from. An autopsy performed on baby John showed that he had been about 3 days old when he was killed. Who was this baby? Who was their mother? And who was responsible for their death? Before we can get into that, we have to understand where and when this story takes place. The town of Kehr-Savin, where baby John was discovered, was one of those small towns where everyone knew everyone else, and there were only 1,300 people who lived there at the time. It looks like a beautiful place, with stunning views of coastal land that apparently makes you feel like you're at the very edge of Europe, as you very nearly would be. When Farmer Jack discovered baby John, he called the Gardaí, which is the name for the Irish police, and Tom Cornyn, the undertaker, was called to the scene of the crime. Tom christened the baby with water from a nearby freshwater stream, as in the Catholic Church, a baby cannot reach heaven without being baptized. You may have a couple of questions after that statement if you aren't familiar with the history of Ireland's government and their ties to the Catholic Church. But first, let's cover why a baby needs to be baptized in the eyes of Catholicism. Then I'll get way into the church and state of it all. The salvation of infants in Roman Catholic ideology was created allegedly by St. Augustine, who believed that children who died unbaptized were damned. Quote, "It is believed as an indubitable truth that otherwise they cannot be made alive in Christ. Baptism is viewed as necessary in the church for salvation, and they believe that baptism is what frees us humans from Adam and Eve's original sin. Therefore, infants who die without being baptized, not being freed from their original sin, go into limbo, derived from the Latin word limbus, roughly translating to the edge of hell. And there's even a specific limbo of infants for all the damned babies to be trapped in purgatory together. Religion is fucked." Now on to the second question. You may ask why the undertaker, otherwise known as a mortician or funeral director, would be giving this baby a baptism. Well, that's because the Catholic Church totally ruled over the country of Ireland. Back in the 1920s and 30s, the capitalist establishment in Ireland made the Catholic Church its ideological wing of the newly formed Irish state, using the church as a tool to maintain social order in a highly fraught political climate. And in turn, they gave Catholic institutions immense power over the lives of Irish people. So this was a time of turmoil in the country, from what I've gathered. They were gaining their independence, and there was a lot of uneasiness about where the country was going and what the people of the country would be doing. And they saw the morality, quote unquote, of the Catholic Church as being a good guide for people to live by, both in their private lives and in the government. What could possibly go wrong? And surprise, surprise, the Catholic Church had the state enact legislation that was unbelievably misogynistic. I know, shocker. There were limitations on women's participation in almost all aspects of her life, like being barred from serving on juries and from working in certain industries. Women were encouraged to become wives and mothers and have many, many babies. And as birth control and all other types of contraception was totally illegal, there were a lot of babies. Oh, and obviously, sex before marriage was a total no-no, but still happened anyway. And it's not like everyone in Ireland was able to support a large family. A really big reason for why a lot of people get an abortion is because they can't afford to have another child. Yes, there was some forms of welfare that were all run by the Catholic Church, but as we're going to talk about in a moment, those options were not always the best. And these women were stuck in abject poverty with their growing families, and they had no option to stop it. On top of that, their husbands were most likely telling them that it was their duties to have more babies as well. And on top of all of that, divorce was also illegal, trapping women in unhappy at best, abusive at worst, homes. The state handed over all welfare duties to the Catholic Church, such as schools, hospitals, and mother-baby homes, or Magdalene laundries. These are places for quote-unquote fallen women in society to work for a roof over their heads. Many women and children who didn't fit into the ideal heterosexual patriarchal family were pushed by the church into institutionalism and other abuses of their human rights. Especially if unmarried girls and women were pregnant, or in the family way, as they called it, you were most certainly being sent to one of these homes, or to a mental institution. Take your pick. They both sound pretty fucking terrible. The last mother-baby home closed as recently as 1998. I find the Magdalene laundries to actually be really fascinating, and I wanted to do an episode all about them. But I think what I'm going to do instead is maybe do a little mini episode on it and throw it on Patreon at some point. So keep an eye out for that. Beginning in 2015, there was an investigation into the treatment of the girls, women, and babies who were being housed in these mother-baby homes. And it was discovered that some 9,000 children died in these church-run homes in over 80 years, which is equivalent to 15% of all of the children who were born or lived in these 18 institutions that were investigated. Oh my God. A nearly 3,000-page report described the emotional and physical abuse that some of the 56,000 women and girls were subjected to in these homes. The reports confirmed that the children there had also been subjected to medical experiments, being used in vaccine trials without parental or guardian consent, and often without being licensed or upholding regulatory standards. These medical experiments were found to be illegal and unethical, even by the standards of the time, and that they would have been in breach of the Nuremberg Code, created after one of the subsequent Nuremberg trials following World War II, which laid out a set of ethical research principles on human experimentation. But with that knowledge, let's go back to a time just before this story took place. In the 1970s, just like in the United States, a women's and civil rights movement came to Ireland. Female workers began demanding rights, and the state reluctantly gave them some. But the Catholic activists noticed the liberalization of abortion laws in other Western countries and began worrying that the same could happen in Ireland. The Pro-Life Amendment campaign was founded in 1981 to campaign against abortion before the 1981 general election. And I do want to hold this up in contrast to what was going on in the United States at the time. Because Roe v. Wade was decided in January 22nd of 1973, and in Ireland at this time, we're in 1981. And there are still very little options out there for women when it came to contraceptions, to abortion, to any sort of reproductive rights. So let me just kind of remind you all of that. Anyway, these Catholic activists worked to make Ireland a model anti-abortion nation by enshrining an abortion ban, not only in law, but in the country's constitution. What does that remind you of? Gosh, I wonder what that would be like. Unfortunately for the women of Ireland, this pro-life campaign would be successful, and a constitutional referendum passed in 1983, 10 years after Roe v. Wade in the United States. This made Ireland's 8th constitutional amendment, quote, acknowledge the right to life of the unborn and give due regard to the equal right to the life of the quote-unquote mother. This measure is very similar to the anti-abortion laws on the books in states like Texas and Kentucky, and it's very much what a lot of these anti-abortion, pro-life activists want to do today. They want to change the way our constitution looks at abortion. On top of the laws on the books, the Catholic Church's patriarchal control had been held over them for so long that putting it on paper only confirmed what many Irish people believed at the time, that having a child out of wedlock was a sin, and that the woman was responsible and had to be punished. On top of that, sex education was essentially non-existent. The church had created the school curriculum for nearly all state schools since Ireland gained its independence in 1922. These schools were employed with religious staff such as priests and nuns, and the schools were paid for by the government and donations from the public. So as you can see, religion and the government were basically one and the same. And there was nowhere safe to turn if you did wind up pregnant, meaning many times women and girls would take matters into their own hands or wind up in one of those abusive mother-baby homes. As for the women who weren't discovered to be pregnant and weren't institutionalized, the 1980s saw a slew of tragic cases involving women dying due to Ireland's strict abortion policies. One young woman almost changed the opinion of many, though, and that was Anne Lovett. Anne Lovett was from County Cork, and she was born on April 6, 1968. She was the 7th of her parents' eventual 9 children. The family moved to County Longford in Granard in 1981, where the family bought a pub and lived in the living quarters above it. There, Anne enrolled in the Canock Maguire Covenant of Mercy. English, biology, and art were her favorite subjects. She was small-framed and stood at only 5'2" tall, but she was still known for her independent and gregarious nature. Her teenage boyfriend Ricky described her later on as being very sharp and very witty, as well as being kind and loving. Ricky remembered being surprised by how much freedom Anne was given compared to him, as she could stay at his house as late as she wanted and even stay over at times. So it seems that there wasn't a lot of parental supervision possibly going on in Anne's life. Anne and Ricky broke up shortly after Anne's 15th birthday, by which time she would have already become pregnant. Ricky had heard rumors at school that she was pregnant and had assumed that the baby was his, as they were sexually active, but no DNA test would be done to confirm this. Allegedly, he had once asked her about the pregnancy and she denied it. There was also another time where Anne came over to Ricky's house late at night, covered in bruises, but the teenaged boy didn't know what to do to help her. In the early morning hours of January 31st, 1984, Anne's sister Trisha, who she usually shared a bed with, woke up to find Anne crying in pain on their bedroom floor. Trisha offered Anne some help, but she told her sister to go back to sleep. Anne's mom, Patricia, saw Anne at 8 a.m. before she left for school, and a neighbor named Bertie reported seeing her on Main Street at around 8:30 a.m. Neither thought there was anything unusual about her behavior. However, Anne didn't attend school that day. When she didn't come home for lunch as usual, her dad assumed that she stayed at school to work on the school magazine. At around 12:30 p.m., Anne visited her friend, Mary McGuire, who lived close to her house. She had previously told Mary in confidence about a month before that she was pregnant, which she had been concealing for months under baggy clothing and skipping PE classes. On that day, she asked Mary to come out with her, but Mary wasn't able to. It's then thought that Anne made her way to an area known as the Grotto, or the Palms, depending on who you ask, behind St. Mary's Catholic Church on a hill overlooking the town. It was raining heavily, and it wouldn't let up all afternoon. Anne lay next to the guardrail of the grotto, near a statue of the Virgin Mary, and gave birth to a full-term 6.5-pound, stillborn baby. She cut the umbilical cord with scissors she had brought and wrapped the baby in her coat. She remained lying on the ground next to him as she hemorrhaged and went into shock. At around 4 p.m., Anne was discovered in the grotto by three schoolboys who quickly ran for help. Anne was still alive, but suffering from exposure and blood loss. Among the adults that came to her aid was a priest, Canon Francis Gilfillan, who administered the last rites to the mother and baby. The baby was given the posthumous baptismal name of Pat. They called an ambulance, and Anne and baby Pat were taken to the hospital along with Anne's mother. Anne was pronounced dead shortly after admittance to the hospital. Anne's last known words, which she spoke to one of the schoolboys, were, "Tell the girls I'm sorry." When media caught wind of this tragedy, hundreds descended upon the small town of Grenard. It wouldn't be discovered until 2018 from one of Anne's other sisters that in December of 1983, Anne had confided in her that their father was violent toward her, showing her red welts on her legs, which she said she had gotten from being beaten with a lead pipe. This led to people wondering if boyfriend Ricky were the father, or if potentially there was something even more nefarious going on. At the time, the public's reaction to this was swift and emotional. The Saturday night after this happened, Ireland's most popular television show, The Late Late Show, with host Gay Byrne, on one of his very last broadcasts, read this headline from the next day's Sunday Tribune paper.
Girl dies giving birth in a field, my goodness me, and that happened in County Longford, apparently. Welsh squelched to victory. What could you do with the prisoners? £443 a day. Nothing terribly exciting there.
Then threw the newspaper onto the floor. The nation was shocked by the story, and it left many wondering how such a thing could have happened. Why did this girl feel like she had to give birth alone? Why did she feel like she had to protect herself? For others, this was an opportunity to share their stories of hiding their pregnancies. The Gay Byrne Show, which began shortly after Anne's death, began to receive letters from all over the country. Gay said it was too many letters. They couldn't be ignored. However, the local clergy, including the nuns at the school which Anne had attended, remained silent, except for making a statement about how they had no knowledge that Anne had been pregnant. Yeah, fucking right. You are grown adults. You most certainly realized that a child was pregnant. And if she was missing all these PE classes, why weren't you asking her what was up? Why weren't you paying closer attention? You probably did notice, and you didn't want to say anything because you thought it would make the school look bad, it would make you look bad, or maybe you were too uncomfortable to bring up this topic of conversation to help this child who clearly needed someone's help. In the National Archives of Ireland documents that were released in 2014, one letter was revealed, written by the Roman Catholic Archdiocese in Ireland, which claimed that Anne's, quote, sad death reflects more on her immaturity than on any lack of Christian charity. Jesus fucking Christ. First of all, so what if she was immature? She was a 15-year-old girl. 15-year-olds are not always super mature. And her immaturity, quote unquote, probably came from ignorance and a lack of education about sex and about pregnancy. And also it came from the immense fear that you have pushed into this child her entire life. Why would she feel that there would be any sort of Christian charity to actually help her? She knew that any Christian charity out there would actually harm her. It's just so, it was just a few months after Anne Lovett's death that the murdered baby John was found. And unfortunately, as it goes far too often in crime stories, this story is not about the poor victim, baby John, as he gets lost in accusations, trials, and a cultural movement. The night before baby John was found, a woman named Joanne Hayes went into labor on her family farm in Abbeydorney, which is about 50 miles away from Cahersaveen. Joanne lived with her mother and two brothers, Mike and Ned, and her sister, Kathleen. Joanne was alone when she gave birth to a baby boy in a hay shed. She had named this baby Shane. It's unclear, but either the baby boy was stillborn or died while being birthed. No one had even known that she had been pregnant. So to keep her secret, the next day, Joanne went and buried baby Shane somewhere on the farm. She was 24 years old at the time and already a single mother to another daughter, Yvonne, who was born on May 19, 1983. Yvonne's father was a man that Joanne had been seeing named Jeremiah Locke. And Jeremiah Locke is a real fucking piece of work. Not a fan. Joanne had met Jeremiah at her job, working as a receptionist at the newly built gym in Tralee. But this wasn't a rom-com meet cute. Jeremiah was married and had children already from another marriage. While abortion was illegal in Ireland, turns out adultery wasn't. Jeremiah was the father to baby Shane, but that wasn't the only baby he was expecting at the time. His wife was due virtually the exact same time as his mistress, Joanne. So classy. Joanne and Jeremiah's relationship was an open secret, so Joanne kept the pregnancy the same way. She never told her family, her co-workers, or any of her friends. By the time she went into labor, she and Jeremiah had broken up. Joanne was completely alone when she gave birth to this child, who clearly didn't have a chance at life. Though Joanne is the only one who knows when the baby died and what exactly happened. After burying Shane, Joanne still needed medical attention, so she checked into the nearby hospital. Now, I know that that story is probably incredibly difficult to listen to. The thought of any person burying their own child and not calling emergency services, not taking this child to the hospital, I think that that's something that a lot of people would have a hard time understanding. And that's why I think the context of what was going on in Ireland at the time is so important, because it was such a scary time for women. Joanne didn't want to be institutionalized, I'm sure. She didn't want to be sent away from her family. She didn't want to be seen negatively by her very small and tight-knit community. I'm sure another layer of that has to do with who the baby's father was and the affair and the drama surrounding that. But I really do think that the most important thing to remember is how she would have been treated by the government had Joanne come forward and said that this baby was stillborn. I don't think that people would generally accept that at the time, and it could have potentially opened up a whole can of worms. And unfortunately, everything bad that could have happened if she did open up about her pregnancy is gonna happen to her anyways. While Joanne was being treated at the hospital, the baby John investigation was going absolutely nowhere. The police went around asking people if they knew anyone in the area who had secretly been pregnant or recently had a baby, and then they looked through a list of names on a registry of new mothers and saw the name Joanne Hayes. This part is a little bit confusing to me because I'm not sure if when Joanne went to the hospital, she stated that she had just given birth, or if maybe because she was being treated for things that are similar to someone who had just given birth that she went onto that list. Either way, the Guardie got a hold of this list and saw Joanne Hayes and the fact that she had apparently given birth the day before baby John was found. So they quickly brought her and her family in for questioning, and Joanne told the Guardie that she could prove to them that she was not baby John's mother. She hadn't even been to Cahors-Sévigné. This questioning would go on for 12 hours with no breaks and no food. She pleaded with them to take her to her baby Shane's grave, for her to show them the proof, but the Guardie refused. Instead, they threatened to throw her in jail and her daughter in an orphanage. The Guardie are fucking awful. Just a few years before this, Amnesty International had published a report alleging systematic maltreatment of suspects by the Guardie, including oppressive methods of extracting statements. It was later reported that the Guardie had slapped, threatened, and coerced Joanne as well as her family members during interrogation. Her brothers in particular had been beaten the most by the detectives. They were also all told that they wouldn't be allowed to go home unless they signed the statement saying that Joanne had intentionally killed baby John. There was a particular group of detectives in County Kerry that were nicknamed the Murder Squad, and I kept seeing reference to them in many of the articles I read, but I really had to dig deep to learn anything specific about the group of men. Usually what came up was an obituary for one of them who had recently passed away. But in a portion from the book, Dark Secrets, The Incredible Story of Joanne Hayes and the Kerry Babies, it reads, quote, "The Murder Squad were an elite group which tended to attract a particular type of personality, lured by its glamour and the opportunity to get involved in high-profile work." One prominent member of the squad and on the Joanne Hayes investigation team was Jerry O'Carroll, who was described as being much like his boss, John Courtney, who at the time was the best known policeman in the area, as a person who had, quote, "sampled the nether regions of humanity." Ugh. Intimidated and scared, Joanne told the police what they wanted to hear, that she had killed baby John and disposed of his body at sea. Her family also falsely confessed to the murder of the baby, but they would all later withdraw their confessions. You may be wondering why someone would confess to something that they didn't do. According to the Innocence Project, research shows that false confessions take place due to law enforcement intimidation, force, coercive tactics, isolation, deceptive methods like lying about evidence, and more. In Joanne's case, she was intimidated, coerced with false information, physically abused. She wasn't allowed to leave even though she wasn't arrested. And they even produced false evidence such as a toilet brush that they had told Joanne she had used to kill her baby. An innocent person may also confess due to increased stress, mental exhaustion, promises of a more lenient sentence, or challenges in understanding their constitutional rights. Joanne and her family were held for over 12 hours with no food or any breaks. They were told that they couldn't go home unless they confessed. So, of course, that's what they did. Her family was released at 1 a.m. in the morning, and Joanne was sent down to the jail cells to await being formally charged with murder the following morning. Her family was charged with concealing the murder.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Anna Sheridan, missing for nearly 6 months now.
I need you to find me.
The Sheridan Tapes, a serialized horror mystery podcast. Stream the complete series today on Realm and on all podcasting platforms.
As the investigation continued, Joanne was sent to a psychiatric hospital, and there she finally convinced the police to recover baby Shane's body from the farm. But now, the Gardaí had two dead infants to account for. The Gardaí must have known at this point that they were wrong about Joanne. Her baby was exactly where she had said it would be. But knowing that you're wrong and admitting that you're wrong are two very different things, especially for law enforcement. They had baby Shane and baby John's blood tested, and the results showed that Shane had type O blood, like Joanne and the baby's father, Jeremiah. And the baby from the beach, baby John, had blood type A. And there you have it. That's the end of the story. They let Joanne out of the hospital, apologized for thinking she was a murderer and treating her family so terribly while interrogating them, and all of Ireland rejoiced, and they all lived happily ever after. Oh, wait. Wrong story. No. Instead, get this. The cops insisted that Joanne must have gotten pregnant simultaneously by two different men and given birth to both children, then murdered both of them. The phenomenon that the Gardaí are talking about here is something called heteropaternal superfecundation. Superfecundation, along with being a really fun word to say, is the fertilization of two or more ova from the same cycle by sperm from separate acts of intercourse, which can lead to twin babies from two separate biological fathers. The idea of this existing would have absolutely terrified younger me. And then there's homopaternal superfecundation, which leads to fraternal twins and comes from two separate ova from the same father. Is this making sense? So the homopaternal one is like normal fraternal twins, and the heteropaternal superfecundation, crazy word to say, is twins with two different dads. And while this is pretty common in animals such as cats and dogs, it is incredibly rare in humans. In one study on humans, the frequency was 2.4% among twins whose parents had been involved in paternity suits. In 1982, twins were born with two different skin colors, and they were discovered to have been conceived as a result of heteropaternal superfecundation in Colombia. With that story going out just a few years before babies John and Shane died, could that have been fresh in the minds of the Gardaí? I don't know. It seems pretty specific. Even so, the blood work should have shown that this isn't possible for Joanne to have been the mother to baby John, no matter who the father was, as she did not share the same blood type at all with the baby. Thankfully, Joanne was finally let out of jail while she waited for trial due to her cousin being able to post bail for her. The community couldn't believe what had happened. The Hayes family was highly respected in the area, with a teacher and a nun in the family. And the neighbors were angered by the way they had been treated by authorities, and they wanted to help Joanne in any way they could. A few months went by, and the Gardaí met with the DPP, the Department of Public Prosecution, where they were told that the prosecution would not be going ahead with the case, as they felt it had fallen apart with the blood evidence. Again, this sounds like fantastic news, right? Wrong. Once these charges were dropped, Joanne and her family reported allegations of police abuse. But the findings of this investigation were inconclusive. The public was also astonished by Joanne's treatment and demanded a further inquiry into the case, though the detectives denied all accusations against them. The story made headlines around the country, leading to the Carrie Babies Tribunal, headed by Justice Kevin Lynch, beginning on January 7, 1985, which was set out to investigate the behavior of the Gardaí in the case and figure out how criminal charges were brought against Joanne in the first place. This is the Gardaí investigating the Gardaí. This was not an independent investigation. So you can already imagine how this is going to go. And I also really want to bring it home that this trial is about the treatment and behavior of the Gardaí. It is not about Joanne Hayes or the babies. In November, prior to the tribunal beginning, the Gardaí commissioner sent out a report to the Minister of Justice stating that the investigating officers were grossly negligent in their handling of the case, but the report was not made public at the time. Joanne and the rest of the Hayes family were to be only witnesses in this trial, as, like I said, they were there to answer questions about the behavior of the police. This was not a murder trial. What came next is described in multiple publications as a witch hunt, and I would have to agree. For months during the tribunal, Joanne's family's private lives were put on public display, and scores of male officials took their turns assassinating Joanne's character, making it really seem like Joanne was the one who was on trial. The tribunal also dug into Joanne's personal and romantic past, showing maps of where Joanne and Jeremiah had been intimate. One doctor showed the size of Joanne's birth canal, and male psychiatrists aired their opinions on her character. One said that Joanne did not seem guilt-stricken enough at the death of her child. Even though sitting through it all, Joanne eventually had to be sedated as she was so visibly upset by what she was hearing during the tribunal. And it was in that sedated state that Joanne was forced to take the stand to testify. She was cross-examined by barristers for 5 days and asked a total of about 2,000 questions on the stand, which was the longest period that a witness had ever been questioned in the history of the state at the time. The questions ranged from interrogating Joanne about when she lost her virginity to whether she used her daughter as ammunition against her married lover, Jeremiah Locke. This is all happening in a room full of men who barely had any understanding of sex, pregnancy, childbirth, or anything to do with a woman's life at the time. I went online and found a few excerpts from the trial, so I'm going to read them to you now. Anthony Kennedy, SC, who was acting for 25 Gardaí based in Dublin and Tralee, suggested to Miss Hayes that she was pregnant with twins by two different men, delivered one baby in the field, then went to sleep, and was woken by the onset of labor of the second baby. This is the questioning between Anthony Kennedy and Joanne Hayes. Kennedy, you continued to bleed after the birth of this baby in the field? Joanne, that is correct. Kennedy, did you know that there is one situation where that most readily happens, and that is where the neck or the cervix of the uterus of the womb does not close because there's another baby expecting to be delivered, and that is the reason for the bleeding? Joanne, I only had one baby. Kennedy, I put it to you that you had more than one. We will come to deal with that in a moment. After you had your baby in the field, the placenta came and you said to yourself, thanks be to God, that is over and done with now. I can go back to live a normal life. Joanne, I never said that. Kennedy, you said that to yourself? Joanne, I did not. Kennedy, or words to that effect? Joanne, no. Kennedy, this embarrassing episode was finished. Nobody need know. I will put the baby in a hole tomorrow morning and that is the end of it. Joanne, no. Kennedy, it did not happen like that. Whatever your mental attitude was when you went to bed, you either slept or did not sleep. But at 2:30, you suddenly realized that after you thought all my troubles were over, here's another one coming. Was that your attitude in the bed? Joanne, no. Kennedy, you called Bridie Fuller, Joanne's aunt. Your baby in the field was an uneventful, normal pregnancy, but not the second one? Joanne, there was only one. Kennedy, the second one was very difficult because being the second of twins, the placenta has not the same space in which to keep away from the baby in the womb. And your second birth was very difficult when you thought all your troubles were over in the field. Is that not so? Joanne, there was only one baby. Kennedy, here you were having delivered the baby in the field, thinking your troubles were over now, suddenly realizing that you were about to produce yourself again in bed. Then you called Bridie Fuller. a very experienced nurse, and you had great difficulty before your baby was born. But in a fever, in a temporary lunatic state, you got the knife and you stabbed that baby as you describe in your statement. What do you say to that? Joanne, that is all untrue. Kennedy, that is all untrue. Not only were you not satisfied with stabbing the baby, you beat that baby with a bath brush as described to the tribunal and as shown to the tribunal by Dr. Harbison. By the way, Dr. Harbison is the state pathologist who carried out the postmortem on Joanne's baby. Joanne, that wasn't my baby. Kennedy, whose baby was it? Joanne, I couldn't tell you. Kennedy, was there another baby born to somebody else in that house? Joanne, no. Kennedy, are you sure? Joanne, yes. Kennedy, when you say, Joanne cuts him off. I did not beat any baby. Kennedy, or strangle any baby? Joanne, no. Kennedy, when you say that wasn't my baby, what do you mean? Joanne, that baby in Cahersaville is not mine. Another man named Martin Kennedy, another Kennedy, Jesus, asked Joanne why she allowed intimacy to take place between her and a married man. Oh, did she allow it? Did she? Go fuck yourself. Joanne admitted that it was because she had fallen in love with Jeremiah. He then asked her if she was living in a fantasy land when Joanne had made a statement about falling in love with Jeremiah and them living happily ever after. Joanne told the court that she knew that their relationship wasn't going to happen after the birth of their daughter, and he stayed with his wife. So no, she was not living in a fantasy land. When asked if she had relations with other men while intimate with Jeremiah Locke during the time that she had become pregnant with baby Shane, Joanne responded, no. Next, she was questioned about how she cut the umbilical cord. Ugh, I don't know why, but this part just like grosses me out so much. Fun fact about me, but it's not so fun. You cannot touch my belly button because it hurts. It hurts really, really bad, like all the way down through my vagina. It's terrible. It's been this way my whole life. I'm convinced that something went wrong in the cutting or tying of my umbilical cord or something because it just, oh, it just hurts so bad. I hate it. So doing research on this and thinking so much about umbilical cords for some reason just like really grossed me out. So Joanne had told the Gardaí that she was able to break the cord with her hands, saying in court, quote, I still swear I pulled at the cord and it broke. Ugh, I don't know why that just grosses me out so much. Allegedly, Dr. Harbison had found a clean cut at the end of the umbilical cord, saying it would have been impossible to be torn. And this got me wondering, if Shane were stillborn, would that have affected his umbilical cord? According to a study I found by the National Library of Medicine, umbilical cord abnormalities are an important risk factor for stillbirth, accounting for 19% of cases studied. So it actually could have been a reason that baby Shane didn't survive. Maybe there was some sort of issue with the umbilical cord where he was unable to get the kind of nutrients that he needed for it to be a successful pregnancy. And if Joanne was concealing this pregnancy and not going to the doctor and getting it checked out, there's no way of knowing how long the baby was around for. But I do wonder if something to do with the death of baby Shane had something to do with how the umbilical cord was able to be cut so clean when she says that she just tore it apart with her hands. If I have any gynecologists or anyone who has more knowledge about this subject than I do who is listening right now, I would genuinely really love an email or DM with more information about this. I'm so fascinated. But it does seem like there is a tie between issues with the umbilical cord and stillbirths. And that's not mentioned anywhere in this tribunal or anywhere in my research. That was just something that kind of popped into my head when I got to this part of the trial. So clearly, this tribunal had gone off the rails, and everyone seems to have forgotten who was really on trial here. The court only saw a woman with loose morals who had had three, according to them, babies out of wedlock, and they were going to make an example out of her one way or another. If they couldn't charge her with murder or anything else, they were going to make damn sure that they were going to ruin her life anyway. One journalist described the treatment of Joanne on the witness stand as being torn like a rag doll. At the end of the tribunal, Judge Lynch found that, while she had no connection to baby John, Joanne did in fact kill baby Shane on the farm, by choking it to stop it from crying and hitting it with a toilet brush, in spite of the state pathologist being unable to determine a cause of death or whether the baby achieved independent life once it was birthed. There was no evidence of a beating of any kind. There was no toilet brush. This was all fabricated by the Gardaí. And this wasn't even what Judge Lynch was asked to determine at the end of this tribunal. I just don't understand. On top of that, Justice Lynch rejected Joanne and her family's claims about the abuses by authorities and the notion that their confessions were obtained through coercion. The tribunal absolved the police of any wrongdoing in 1985, and the officers central to the case were all eventually promoted. You heard that right. I just can't believe that this happened, that there was no one to be like, wait, pause. This isn't what we're supposed to be talking about. We're supposed to be investigating the Gardaí and their behavior toward Joanne right now. We're not supposed to be investigating and putting a woman on trial for murder. I just don't understand. And clearly, even though the public was so on the side of Joanne and her family, she was humiliated, and I'm sure she felt like her life was completely ruined by this entire tragedy. And on top of that, she is mourning the fact that she still lost a baby, baby Shane, and people are telling her that she's the one that ended his life. That is so terrible for a grieving person to have to go through. So I don't blame her when she returned home to Abbey Dorney and remained hidden from the world for the next 34 years. And during that entire time, baby John's killer was never found. As for the public, they were outraged by the treatment of Joanne and her family. Protesters stood outside the courthouse holding signs claiming that Joanne is a victim, not a murderer. It seems like the people of Ireland had begun to grow tired of the hypocrisy of power in this country and were finally standing up for women to be seen and treated as more than second-class citizens. As Judge Lynch left the building, the crowd shouted, "Who's on trial?" And an escort service had to see him through the crowd. Judge Lynch published his final report on October 3, 1985, presenting Joanne as a malicious liar who pursued a married man. Her family was also presented as being liars, and the Gardaí were effectively exonerated. It was also never explained in the report how the Gardaí got the confessions from the Hayes family to begin with. After the Carey babies case, the entire murder squad was disbanded. They believed that they were sacrificed. And former Gardaí detective Jerry O'Carroll had this to say about it.
We were sacrificed. As I said, they threw out the baby with the bathwater. They scattered us to the four corners. You know, many of us who were involved in that. I was the social pariah after it, Garda pariah.
Don't we think we could have used a better metaphor in this situation, Jerry? And to this day, these men still feel that they were in the right when it came to Joanne's case, and that they had never done anything wrong in their investigations. They still see themselves as the scapegoats, and Joanne as a double baby murderer. But their demotions would not last long, as Detective Jerry O'Carroll, for example, would soon be back at his role as detective after spending some time on desk duty, and then even promoted to Sergeant Inspector. And Superintendent John Courtney was promoted to Chief Superintendent and retired in 1991. And John Courtney, the one who is said to have been familiar with the nether regions of humanity, was promoted to Chief Superintendent and retired in 1991. Years after the tribunal, Jerry and another detective, P.J. Brown, sued Joanne Hayes after she wrote her memoir called My Story for using defamatory language about them within the pages. You fucking snowflakes, you can dish it out, but you can't handle it. This matter was settled out of court, and each of the men received £17,500 and a public apology from Joanne. Are you kidding me? We're in the 90s now. Superintendent John Courtney wrote his own memoir in 1996, which he called It Was Murder, saying that all of the allegations of this Gardaí murder squad gang, the stories of beating up prisoners and innocent people as all being unfounded. Jerry O'Carroll agreed, denying any existence of a so-called heavy gang. He said, quote, We were good interrogators. We put the fear of God into people, but we never touched them. To that extent, they might regard us as the heavy gang. You don't have to touch someone to coerce them, and you did. You did touch them. You hurt them. Later on, Joanne took out a high court action against the state to have the findings of the tribunal overturned. In 2018, 3 decades after the deaths of baby John and baby Shane, the Gardaí and the state finally apologized to Joanne and acknowledged their errors in the case. Well, kind of. In the review, they confirmed that Joanne was not the mother of baby John, and a new investigation into baby John's killer was launched. On the morning of September 14th, 2021, the remains of baby John were exhumed by the Gardaí and taken to the morgue in Tralee for examination. On March 23, 2023, the Gardaí announced that a man in his 60s and a woman in her 50s had been arrested on suspicion of murder in Munster and were being held in relation to the case after DNA tests found that they were the parents of baby John. The couple has denied any role in the murder of their infant, and I don't know what is going to happen with this going forward, as proving the parentage of the baby would be much easier than proving if they murdered this child or not. So I'm going to keep an eye on that, since clearly this case is still ongoing. There will hopefully still be justice for baby John, and I will keep you all updated on that as well. Jerry O'Carroll, when asked if he was sorry for dragging Joanne into the case, he said, "I have only sympathy for 2 creatures in this, the babies. And that's my final word on it." We know, because babies are more important than women. There, I finished your sentence. In 2020, Joanne and her family finally received substantial compensation by the state, but still no criminal proceedings have been brought against any members of the Gardaí. As for the rest of the women in Ireland, things would finally begin to change. In 1985, the Health Act allowed the sale of condoms and spermicides to people over the age of 18 in Ireland without needing a prescription. Attorney General versus X in 1992 was a landmark Irish Supreme Court case which established the right of Irish women to obtain an abortion if the pregnant woman's life was at risk because of the pregnancy, including the risk of suicide. In 2013, the Protection of Life During Pregnancy Act was signed into law, which didn't fully repeal the Eighth Amendment, but legalized abortions that would protect the pregnant person's life. But then, in 2018, the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution, which recognized the unborn as having a right to life equal to that of the mother, was repealed. Today, legal abortions in Ireland are now allowed during the first trimester, with the cost even being covered by the public health service. Are you kidding me? We're going backwards and Ireland has free abortions? I'm moving. And I can't help but see the parallels between 1980s Ireland and where the United States is heading in 2024. Before the laws began to change in Ireland, the pregnant would travel what was known as the abortion trail to England in order to procure an abortion. It's estimated that roughly 170,000 people have traveled from Ireland to seek legal abortions between 1980 and 2018. In the U.S., pregnant people are needing to travel to other states in a manner very similar to the abortion trail out of Ireland. Unlike in the United States, Ireland is moving away from political control over private life and religious control over private life. The story of the Carey babies and Joanne Hayes should be a cautionary tale for what pregnant people in the United States could face as we seem to be going back in time as our laws against abortion become more and more strict and regulated. That is the end of the story of the Carey babies and Joanne Hayes. It's a rough one. There are a lot of really tough things discussed in this episode. If you do need any sort of mental health assistance after listening, as always, I would recommend getting in contact with the RAIN Network, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, at 1-800-656-4673 or go to their website at rainrainn.org. If you are struggling with suicidal thoughts and this is an emergency, please stop this episode immediately and dial 988. And if you are able to donate in any way to help fight these terrible abortion laws and abortion bans going on in the United States, I would highly recommend going to www.abortionfunds.org. I don't know why I added the www, maybe just for fun. You can also check out the National Abortion Federation website at prochoice.org/donate if you want to donate. I would also say definitely look into the Planned Parenthood website. Go online and see if there are any groups in your areas who are doing any activism, if that is something that you are interested in doing. And definitely do not forget the Carrie Babies and Joanne Hayes. I really hope that you all enjoyed that episode. Thank you for waiting for it. I really appreciate all of your patience as usual. And now that I'm done with that, I am going to be writing another episode for Mad Gabbin with Madigan. I have kind of a fun topic that randomly popped into my head, and I thought it would be kind of interesting to do some research on and chat about with you all on Patreon. So if you want to become a member, go to patreon.com/angryneighborhoodfeminist and join over there. I really, really appreciate it. It helps keep this show running. The more patrons I get, the more work I can do on this show in particular. So I really, really appreciate everyone who has joined recently. If you want to support the show in another way, you can also leave me a 5-star review and a quick sentence about why you enjoy the show on Apple Podcasts. It truly makes such a huge difference, even though it is such a silly little thing. And you can also rate the show on Spotify as well. That's not going to hurt. Okay, everyone, I'll see you on Friday with a brand new mini What's in the News episode. Until then, that's all I have for you today. With all that being said, I encourage you to rage on. Bye.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Get inspired while learning all about the unique planes of existence. Get the in-depth knowledge you need to help your combat encounters feel impactful, or learn about the origins and pantheons of every race and class the game offers. No stone is left unturned as every edition of the game is explored and explained in a way that benefits players of all different levels of experience. You can expand your TTRPG horizons in a way that's as entertaining as it is educational just by listening. All you have to do is go to your favorite podcast app or YouTube and search for The Dungeon Cast.